Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by the Heritage Meat Shop, located in the historic Essex Street Market in New York City. For more information, visit heritagemeatshop.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome back to Ferment About It, a show on all things fermentable, with a particular focus in home brewing. I'm your host, Mary Izette. My co-host, Mr. Chris Kuzme, is out of the country at the moment, so I'm alone today. You can hear us live every Monday at 7 p.m. on Heritage Radio Network. So today we're going to play an interview that I was very, very lucky to get with Dr. Fritz Brehm. I spoke to him at the backyard of the Diamond in Brooklyn, New York, last Tuesday. Dr. Fritz Brehm has received his PhD in brewing studies at Weihenstephan in Germany. He's also served as director of education at the Siebel Institute in Chicago and director of Domens, Germany. And he's currently the director of technology and product development at Boon Rod Brewery in Thailand. You probably know him as the inventor and producer of this amazing series of historical beers that Be United brings into the country. So, on to the interview.
See, so you're Dr. Fritz Brehm, and he is the creator of this very special series of historical style of beers. So let's talk about how did you start that project. A little bit about the background of how that got started.
Well, actually, the background has been that I've been approached by Matthias Neithardt.
Mm-hmm. From Be United.
Who is a very creative guy, you know. And we ran into each other basically by accident. So we met in Düsseldorf at the Ürige. And he was exposing me or asking me if I do have any idea about historical beer styles, you know. Basically, he was asking my friend, you know, but I was sitting close to them and just listening at the beginning. So my friend, he's the owner of a small brewery, and he was saying, okay, well, it sounds interesting, but I'm doing commercial beers, and I have to make money with my beers. But I have, here is a guy sitting, you know, who is crazy enough to start with something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought maybe that's a nice challenge. And then I talked to Matthias, what he expects. And he wasn't not really sure himself, but he was saying he wants to go back to the basics. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So saying, what could you do now with the equipment and all the ingredients you have now available? By thinking what were the limitations in the past.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like saying the brewers 200, 300 years ago, they had to take what they got, you know, like not real brewing barley, they had just feed barley.
Mm-hmm.
They had no pure culture yeast, no pure bacteria, so it was basically spontaneous fermentation. I'm always saying it was spontaneous production, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And from that perspective, I was thinking maybe we can do or make something out of that, and it might be fun. And then we started with the 1809, so with the so-called Berliner Weisse.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I have to say, in Germany, if somebody approaches you in Germany, and I'm from Bavaria, you know, you can never do a Berliner Weisse, because that means legally, Berliner Weisse has to come from Berlin.
Okay. Right.
So me, or being my brewery, being based in close to Munich,
mm-hmm.
I can legally never do a Berliner Weisse. So Matthias said, don't worry, we do a Berliner Weisse style,
mm-hmm.
which is just a way around getting around that, you know. So, okay, I said, let's try that. And I do have kind of a background in working with lactic acid bacteria and other bacteria.
Okay.
So I'm thinking the best way to do that is go back to the roots, you know, and think how did these guys during the days when Berliner Weisse was kind of invented, or when the people drank that, how did they approach that part, you know? And that means basically you have to go back to very strange mashing regimes. That means you acidify the mash basically already.
Okay.
Which is more or less also coming now more and more within the purity law.
Mm-hmm.
Because in Bavaria or in Germany you can't add any acid,
right,
by law.
Right.
So you do have to produce it naturally. And usually you acidify the wort. But in a Berliner Weisse, the point is the people acidified the mash already.
Okay.
By accident.
By accident, right.
Yeah, really, because if you're mashing at low temperatures, what's happening is that the bacteria on the malt or on the barley or on the wheat, whatever,
right,
they grow.
Yes.
You know, like if you have temperatures between 30 and 40 degrees.
In Celsius?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sorry for that.
No, that's fine. Well, I just want to make that clear.
Yeah, right. So these bacteria will grow.
And that's at long periods of time, though, right? I mean...
Right, it depends, you know, what do you want to reach? If you want to really get a strong acidification,
mm-hmm,
it can take up to 24, 36 hours. But this time, normally in an industrial brewery, is not available, you know?
So, right, yeah.
So it doesn't make sense.
Right.
But that was the first part. We said, okay, let's give the natural flora on the malt the chance to do something.
Mm-hmm.
You know? The risk here is, and that was a challenge, that you really never know which natural flora you have,
right,
you know,
yes,
on the malt.
Yes.
So depending where it's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
So there was kind of the challenge was how long would you really mash at the low temperature? We call it degarieren, which is a German word.
Mm-hmm.
Degarieren. Not many people know that word anymore.
No, I don't.
But it means that you keep the mash at the low temperature so that the microorganisms
can grow. Okay.
Yeah, that's basically it. The problem is that if you do it too long, so you get a pre-digestion of the wort carbohydrates,
mm-hmm,
and the big problem is that other bacteria, other aerobic bacteria, are growing too.
Right.
And you get this cabbage-like and these bacterial flavor which you can't get out of the beer anymore.
Right.
Out of the
and are undesirable.
Yeah. Well, the problem is what is desirable and what's not,
yeah,
desirable. You know, that's kind of how you define it.
Yeah.
You know, but the point is, we used a trick then. We said, okay, most of the lactic acid bacteria cannot stand alpha acids or cannot stand hops.
Right, yes.
So let's do kind of a pre-separation of what you like and what you don't like. So let's add some hops to the mash already, which is very unusual,
mm-hmm,
to suppress some of the lactic acid that you don't like and keep the ones you like.
Mm-hmm.
But that's basically trial and error.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And then don't do that too long, but let's then further mash the wort and transfer or keep these organisms through to fermentation by not boiling the wort.
Mm-hmm.
So basically you have two steps. The first step is you suppress the non-desirable lactic acid bacteria,
mm-hmm,
by adding some hops to the mash.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, you keep the ones you like by not boiling the wort.
Right.
Which is what has been done in ancient times,
right,
too. You know, that's what
it, yeah, and I, like I told you, I made a Berliner Weisse before, and I did not boil. So,
which is
it's a little scary as a home brewer and as a brewer, professional.
Yeah, as an industrial brewer, you would never
absolutely
do that. But that combination worked out quite well, you know.
Yes, it's a delicious beer.
Well, I mean, technically.
Okay.
Okay. So technically, it worked out quite well, and so we we were able to keep some of these bacteria for the fermentation. And then for the primary fermentation, we added pure culture yeast to the natural lactic acid bacteria, which have been in the wort already.
Right.
Okay. So by that, you get a nice flavor, depending on the yeast strain you choose.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, and that's now quite specific, especially for a Berliner Weiss, because you can't boil anymore. But you want to then further suppress the growth of some of these bacteria. So what I did here is I added additional hops during fermentation.
Okay.
Which is very unusual.
Yes, you know? Very.
But by that, you can suppress the growth of these bacteria, but you can keep the activity of the yeast. And then you go to what we call final attenuation. So you just let it ferment.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next point is that I didn't want to live with, let's say, spontaneous fermentation. So I was thinking to bring the attenuation down, further down, we have to add other yeasts, you know, like yeast which people were thinking were in the air, or some bacteria which you would find in spontaneous fermentations.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went for bread. So we chose a specific bread strain,
mm-hmm.
which we add as a pure culture then.
At the after fermentation, or initial fermentation?
After initial fermentation,
okay.
You know. And that's the typical, so now I have to go back to my Bavarian roots, so that's the typical bottle fermentation, but
mm-hmm.
not with a traditional Aloy lager yeast then, but with bread.
Okay.
You know, and that was basically the idea. So the idea was, it's a combination of, I would call it technical tricks,
mm-hmm.
you know, which would theoretically have been available during that time, but the people simply didn't know it. You know?
Right, right.
But basically it's not rocket science. It's simply the application of brewing knowledge to old styles, to old beer styles.
Right.
So very simple. So that was basically the Berliner Weiss thing.
Excellent.
Yeah, easy.
I wouldn't say easy. I thought that's a very creative approach. And
it is creative, but for me, the main message for that kind of beer is, if you understand the brewing process, if you understand that, I always compare yeast and bacteria to human beings, you know? And if you treat them well, and you choose the right persons for the right job,
right, yes.
you know, then it's working, you know?
Yes.
That's the same with beer, you know? Choose the right ingredients with the right people or the right organism, it will turn out well.
Right. Excellent.
Very simple.
You're listening to an interview with Dr. Fritz Brehm on Ferment About It. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in a minute.
You're listening to Bohemia on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The following is a message from the Heritage Meat Shop.
Are you tired of just hearing buzzwords? Do you want to actually take part in the food revolution? Then come on down to the Heritage Meat Shop, located in New York's historic Essex Street Market, on the corner of Essex and Delancey. We have rare breed pork, beef, poultry, lamb, and goat, not to mention charcuterie that'll make you squeal. All raised right, by the right people, so you know they'll taste right. Try the meat that over 100 New York chefs ache for. Come to the Heritage Meat Shop and pick up some revolution today.
For more information, visit heritagemeatshop.com.
And then let's talk about the Gretzer, or the Gretzky. I'm terrible at pronunciation, but what's the official pronunciation?
Well, in German it would be Gretzer.
Gretzer?
Yeah. But internationally I think it's better known as Gretzky. So basically it's the name of a region or a town, basically a region.
Mm-hmm.
And the beer style, to my knowledge, basically didn't exist anymore.
Right.
It was basically dead. No. But if you really look back and try to collect some information about that beer style, it's also very interesting, you know, because it's something nobody does, to my knowledge, anymore, and that's smoked wheat, you know, the use of smoked wheat.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes sense to me, you know, to stabilize cereals, smoking, or food, you know, mm-hmm. to stabilize food, smoking has always been a tool.
Right.
You know, because you can't put too many tons of malt into the fridge.
Right.
So stabilize it differently. Yeah. So smoked wheat, I think, is interesting. And what I also like very much with the Gruditsky is that I think during these times, like what I mentioned before with the Berliner Weiss, the mashing was always a problem, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You even don't know if they really had the option to heat up properly,
mm-hmm.
to measure the temperature really in the right way. But I think also the during that time, most of the beer has been naturally acidified. So not necessarily to really get an acidity, a really low pH, but more or less by accident, which in the end turned out that it's better for the product stability, and also for the consumer, you know, it's safer.
Mm-hmm.
Because the product is preserved and it's better for the body, you know, for the digestion, it stimulates everything. So I would say that the combination of smoking and natural acidification in a Gretzer, for me, is a point which gives room to produce interesting beers, you know.
Yes, I agree.
And especially with the wheat, you know, and with the acidification of the mash, you liberate a part of the wheat which normally is lost with the spent grain, you know. So you liberate more as what you would bring into solution with a regular mash. So the interesting thing here is, like, if you are experienced in brewing, normally, you know, lautering takes max 2, sometimes 3 hours, you know, depending mm-hmm. on your equipment. In an industrial brewery, you go for 1 hour, you know, that's it. If you're doing that with the smoked wheat and with the acidification of the mash, well, with our Gruditsky, it takes between 10 and 12 hours.
To
lauter, yeah.
Wow.
So that's, which is really a pain in the ass.
Yes. Yes.
And you think, oh, right, what's going on here? You know, but in the end, it turns out it's worth it, you know, because what you really get then is the reason why it's lautering so slowly is the viscosity is relatively high,
mm-hmm.
because you're liberating many of the glucans and in the carbohydrates you normally don't want to have in the mash or
right.
in the wood. And that's also interesting then, because these components are finally then during fermentation, they are not to 100% fermented. And this gives a lot of room then if you add cross-contaminations by accident or in a planned way, gives a lot of room that the beer can develop in the bottle, you know, during bottle fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're leaving carbohydrates which are not fermented and you're transferring that into the bottle, and then they develop a very nice basis, or they are a nice basis for additional fermentations,
right,
taking
place. Right, because there's more food left basically for the yeast and bacteria
right basically for the bacteria, mm-hmm. who create then the food for the yeast,
right? Okay,
so now that's, you're going through different steps, you know, you're not going with food into the bottle,
mm-hmm.
but you're going with something into the bottle which can be converted by bacteria and then creates food for the yeast again.
Okay.
And that's, I was thinking that's quite interesting.
Yes.
You know?
I didn't realize.
Yeah, it's the point really here is it's the combination of smoking, acidity, and development in the bottle. And the funny thing with the Gorlicki is that if you work in the fermentation area,
mm-hmm.
immediately after pitching or the first 2 days after pitching, well, you can't stay there for a long time because the smoke is so tremendously coming out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you think, oh, I think that beer doesn't turn out very well, you know.
So yeah.
It's kind of a frustration,
mm-hmm.
you know. But what you then see is that because of the acid in combination with the metabolism then in the bottle, this aggressive smoke disappears.
Right.
And it turns out as being just a hint of smoke, finally,
mm-hmm.
and very acceptable and nice.
I agree.
So, but it takes time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the worst thing with the Gorlicki is that it needs a lot of time during maturation.
Bottle fermentation.
In the mm-hmm. bottle fermentation. And, you know, what you have to see here is it's a combination of maturation in the tank
mm-hmm.
and after that, bottle fermentation. So, which is very unusual, you know,
mm-hmm.
because normally you go for primary fermentation in an open ferment,
mm-hmm.
and then you go to the bottle. What we do with the Gorlicki is we have an open fermenter, then we go to a horizontal ferment, it's a closed maturation tank.
Mm-hmm.
Then, during that time, we transfer it 3 times to take it from the yeast, we cloison it 2 times, and then we go into the bottle.
Wow.
So it's really, it's a lot of many steps in between.
So how long does it take from the initial when it's ready in the bottle, when it's ready to drink?
The point is, when it's in the bottle, it's not ready to drink.
Right.
You know, but you can drink it, theoretically, but...
But ideal, like how, you know, taking in time, maturation in the bottle.
Okay, let's say it that way, you know. We put it into the bottle approximately, I would say, after between 3.5 and 4 months.
Okay, wow.
So we keep in the brewery quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the bottle, you know, you can drink it, but to get a reasonable result, you know, that it's really what we normally would expect, smooth and balanced and not too unbalanced, I would say you need another 2 months
okay.
in the bottle. So that's
6 months.
Yeah, it's long.
Yeah, that's a very long time for a commercial beer, especially.
It is a long time.
Yeah.
But I think it's worth it, you know. And I know that it's some people hate it. Which is fine. You know?
Everyone's got their own taste.
Yeah, that's right. But I think in the end, it's quite balanced.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. Yeah. That's what I'm drinking now, and it's absolutely delicious. I was thrilled when I read that this beer was coming. I had home brewed it a year and a half or so ago, and then when I read that we were going to get this, I was very excited and absolutely thrilled when I first had it. And I think it's delicious. So.
Yeah, it's different.
Yeah.
You know, very different, but. I think it's worth at least a try, you know.
Oh, I agree.
And I don't know what was your experience with your homebrew you did, but I don't know if you had the same approach, you know.
No, I mean mine was much simpler process. I've only made it once, but
okay.
But it was I used to smoke my own malt. I've smoked my own malt, and I've made several beers with my house smoked malts. And there is some unpredictability there, I think. Although I think also purchasing smoked malts, there's definitely unpredictability as well.
Well, to be honest.
Well, as a home brewer.
Well, but I smoked it myself too.
You did? Okay.
No.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I bought smoked malt
mm-hmm.
from a very reliable company who's selling smoked malt from. Actually, for that, you know, not too many on the market.
Right.
I bought it from the red one.
Yes.
And but my feeling was, you know, it was. It's not enough, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You need extra, and especially getting the smoked wheat, you basically have to do it yourself.
Right.
So, but it's not rocket science, you know.
Right.
To smoke it, but like you're saying, is consistency is the problem.
Oh, I can imagine. So, yeah.
But actually, it was okay.
To smoke it yourself?
Yeah. Many people thought that this guy is crazy now, you know, he's smoking in right. his backyard.
Yes, yes.
But it's fine, you know.
No, it's fun, I thought.
Well, I was used to that, you know, because what I remember is when I grew up, you know, I saw my dad and my grandfathers smoking or sulfuring hops.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Because that's what the people did in the past, you know, especially if you want to keep it in your living room, you know, and you want the vines to stay green.
Right.
You have to sulfur them, you know. So you burn sulfur.
Right.
Smoke the vines with sulfur.
Sulfur, okay.
So I was thinking maybe it's the same concept.
Right. yeah.
To some extent it is. And that was it, you know. That was the reason why I did it.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. I mean, I think it's wonderful that you're doing these beers. Do you have plans to bring a fourth? Do you have some ideas that are in the back of your head?
Yeah, there are some ideas. But the problem is the challenges are still too high
mm-hmm.
at the moment, you know.
Right, because right.
We're having some plans, but some honey will be involved and molasses or, you know, so, which is an absolutely different stuff, you know, because I don't want to use honey and molasses as an adjunct as such.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to use it as a basis to produce different flavors during fermentation, so as a substrate for the fermentation.
Okay,
and
right.
And not simply as a carrier of aroma in the final product.
Right, because honey and molasses have different sugars and carbohydrates than traditional malt.
And the one thing is the sugar profile, but the other thing is that especially with honey, there are many components in the honey which inhibit the growth of bacteria and yeast.
Mm-hmm.
So and that's the point now is how can we find a way around that?
Right.
But I think it's a nice challenge, and in the end we will see.
Yes, it sounds very, very interesting.
I hope it is.
No, I think that's. I look forward to having. I mean, many more of the 1809 and the Gorditsky, and then also for future projects. So. Yeah.
But the good thing is the for me the 1809 is a future project as such, because if you simply leave it, it's always changing.
Right.
So you know, let's just wait what's coming out of that.
Right. It's an evolution.
Yeah, right. That's correct.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. So that was my interview with Dr. Fritz Brehm. I also got a short section on Groot, which we'll play on an upcoming episode on Groot beers that will be next year. Just a reminder, next week we will be our last show of the year. We're going to be taking Christmas Eve and January 31st off, and we'll return in the new year in January. So next week we're going to continue talking about historical styles and how you can brew them as a home brewer. My friend and an excellent home brewer, Matt Chan, will be in the studio with me to talk about how you can brew your own Grätzer and Berliner Weiss at home. And we maybe hit a couple other styles, like one of my favorite, the Lichtenhainer. So Fritz, I was so excited to get that interview, and he gave me so much information. I went into that thinking, hey, he'll maybe talk to me for 5 minutes, and instead he talked to me for almost 24. So I was thrilled, especially that he was willing to share so much information. So some of the takeaways I thought were, or things that we'll explore is adding hops to the mash. That's one thing I haven't done. We'll talk about different ways to sour mash, what yeast strains that you can use, how to get over the scare of not boiling, adding hops during fermentation, Brettanomyces at bottling, and then also long lagering. That's one thing, 100% wheat beer or a wheat beer with over 50% wheat in the grain bill is scary, and stuck mash is a problem. However, with brew in a bag, which you guys should know is one of my favorite techniques, you don't have to worry about that. I've done actually 100% rye beer and 100% wheat beer using brew in a bag with no worries of a stuck sparge. Sorry, not a stuck mash, a stuck sparge, since you don't need to sparge. So we will talk about those things as well. A reminder that Pour to Restore will the benefit put on by homebrewers for Staten Island is going to be on December 23rd. Chris Kuzmi and I will be pouring a beer there. You can go to pourtorestore.com for all the information. So again, I'll be back next week with Matt Chan to talk about how you can brew these historical styles of beer at home. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Mary Izette with Foment About It on heritageradionetwork.org. Talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.